All right, well, we're going to go ahead and continue in our study in, we've been in the book of Genesis. We're doing Bible overview in 40 points. Some weeks we'll go back and, you know, spend time trying to review and see if by the time we get to point number 40, we kind of have them down. So on a regular basis, I'll show these to you. This morning, I'm not going to take a lot of time to review the 40 points. But just to say quickly that the first 6 points were under this Roman numeral 1 beginnings, with the second 6 points being under Roman numeral 2, the beginning of Israel. And under that point, first 4 points here you could think of as the patriarchs, the fathers of Israel, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and whose name will change to Israel, or at least he'll have a second name today, and in today's lesson, and then Joseph. All right, so that's where we're going to pick up. I'm trying to go through the material as quickly as I can so that 40 points doesn't take 40 years to cover. So it is an overview. I'm doing my best on it. I'd kind of like to, you know, cover one or more than 1 point a week. But some of these points, especially here in the beginning, cover a lot of material, as you can see by the number of chapters that are associated with each person. Okay. All right, well, last week we left off with Jacob, and we didn't get a chance to finish Jacob, so we're going to go ahead and finish Jacob today, then we're going to get into Joseph, and we're not going to cover all of Joseph, but we'll get as far as we can with the time that we have, okay? All right, and so I'm going to go ahead and continue with Jacob. Recent weeks, we looked at the birth of Esau and Jacob. Of course, he's the son of Isaac and Rebekah. Then we saw how Esau sold his birthright to Jacob, and then how Jacob tricked his dad into giving him the blessing instead of the blessing going to Esau. It would have normally gone to the oldest child in the family. And so that's kind of where we left off, because at the end of chapter 27 of Genesis, and also in chapter 28, we see his mom, Rebekah, who had helped Jacob be deceitful. And we see this kind of a life pattern of Jacob. And by the way, we do learn from these examples. The Bible gives us truth. And part of the truth is showing us the flaws of these men who were godly men and loved the Lord, but they didn't always do things the right way. And you certainly see that in the life of Jacob. And you're going to see a growth pattern, I think, in Jacob, some humility. Sometimes that's not uncommon if there's any young men listening out there. I don't have any young men in the room here. But sometimes young men, myself, no exception, I'm not young anymore, but when I was young, we have a tendency towards arrogance. And, of course, mankind in general, male or female, has pride problems, and so this is one of the biggest things that we struggle with as humans. Well, Jacob was no exception to that, and but he struggled maybe more than most with this problem of being a trickster, which, of course, prophetically, his parents naming him Jacob, which has that idea of being that kind of deceiver. I think prophetically the Lord laid that on their heart to name him that, and we see that that is true. All right. Excuse me while I fight off a sneeze. I don't really care to sneeze. I don't know if how you fight off sneezes. Do you ever push on your nose? I do that. Anyways, it's not going to be fun to sneeze inside a mask, so I had to fight that off. All right, it's gone, so it worked. Well, in Genesis chapter 27, mom Rebecca says to her son, "You got to get out of here now that you just tricked your brother out of the blessing. Esau is going to kill you." Literally. And now he's kind of waiting for his dad to pass away. He doesn't want his dad to have to deal with that or know about that. But she helps Jacob get out of there. She tells her husband Isaac a reason why she thinks Jacob should get out of the area. She doesn't tell him the full truth of what she's thinking about Esau wanting to kill him. But she does say, "I don't want my son to marry someone in this area, one of the pagan women of this area. Let's send them back." Of course, that's how Isaac had gotten his wife, Rebekah. "Let's send them back. Let me send them to my brother Laban and live with him." And so that's what she tells at the beginning of chapter 28 to her husband. So chapter 28, verse 5, Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Padan Aram unto Laban, who was the son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah. In past weeks we looked at maps, and this would be in that fertile crescent going from Mesopotamia over to Israel. It's kind of towards the top area of that crescent shape. Okay? So it would be what we would think of as northern Iraq, northwest or northeastern Syria, if we were looking at maps today, maybe right there above the country of Jordan. Okay, so let's go continue on then. So Jacob's on his way to his brother, to his uncle Laban, and in chapter 28, verse 10, Jacob, on his way there, he has this dream. And the dream is really a confirmation of God going to fulfill Abraham's covenant through Jacob. Remember, there had been some, a little bit of wondering there for a little bit. Abraham's thinking it's going to be through my son Ishmael, and God's like, no, it's going to be through Isaac. And now Isaac's son Jacob, it's a confirmation that God's intending it to go through him. We read this in starting in chapter 28, verse 12. Jacob dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to the heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it. Now, he's not to Padan Aram yet. He's still in the land of Canaan, the promised land. And so as he's traveling, the Lord has this dream. And he says, I'm going to give this land to you and to your seed. Verse 14, he goes on to describe aspects of the Abrahamic covenant, what we often call this covenant that originally he gave to Abraham. And so we have that, again, that confirmation with Jacob. Okay, so again, moving along, let's go to chapter 29. So he arrives at his uncle Laban's house. And, well, he doesn't arrive at the house. I think he starts the journey and tells us in 29 verse 2, he looked and behold a well in the field, and there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks, and a great stone was upon the well, the mouth of the well. And all the flocks in the area, verse 3 tells us, they would come and they would water the sheep, and they put the stone on it again. And so he started asking the people in the area if they know of Laban, the son of Nahor, and they said, we know him. And he asks if it is his well, and they identify, yes, it is. And behold, there's his daughter Rachel, verse 6, coming with her sheep. And so he meets up, again, long story short here, he meets up with her. He greets her in verse 11, that Middle Eastern greeting kiss that's there. So that's not Jacob smooching with Rachel in verse 11. That'll come later. Tells her all about what's gone on and wanting to live with Laban, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so Laban, it tells us in verse 16, had two daughters. And so Laban allows him to stay with him. The Bible tells us also in verse 17, a little bit of a description of their looks. Basically, Leah's not that great looking, and Rachel is very pretty. And so it's always had a kind of a unique wording here. Leah was tender-eyed, weak-eyed. Heard one way it could mean cow-eyed. I don't know exactly what that phrase means. I've heard different things on it. I will say one source that I was looking at, one commentator, mentioned that they thought it was indicating blue eyes. Well, blue eyes are weaker in some ways. Just ask those if they're working out of the sun a lot. You can have problems with your eyes because the lack of, well, they didn't know this at this time, of course, but the lack of melanin in the eyes doesn't give you as much sun protection. Brown-eyed people, you have brown eyes because your eyes have melanin in them. But anyways, that's a possibility. I'm going to read this other description here. This is a different commentator, I believe. Leah had weak eyes and consequently was not so good-looking, since bright eyes with fire in them are regarded as the height of beauty in women of that region. So I don't know. It's not that big a deal, I think, one way or the other. So it might be in their culture. Well, it's like with us. I mean, people have their preferences on looks. So it'd be like saying, you know, some people think whether you're female or male, you know, a guy with brunette hair, I really like the way that looks. I like redheads, you know. So apparently he had his preferences here. And, well, regardless, he thought Rachel beautiful and fell in love with her. And he agrees in verse 20 with 19 and 20 with Laban to Laban's going to allow him to marry Rachel, but he's going to have to work for her. And of course, in that culture, the idea of having a dowry or the family being compensated some when a daughter would leave the family and marry and basically become part of another family, that they would get compensated in some way with some sort of a dowry. And so he agrees to work for his future father-in-law, Laban, for 7 years. And the Bible tells us, verse 20, that 7 years seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had to her. So he didn't mind that at all, because he was so wanting to marry her. Okay. All right, I'm going to keep this moving along here. So we get to the end of the 7 years, and Jacob says, okay, 7 years up, I want my wife. And I got to assume, reading between the lines, that she was fine herself with getting married and would like to marry him. And Jacob becomes the receiver of deceit at this point. I guess I haven't really put up my next point. Jacob marries Leah and Rachel. There's not a lot of info there, but let me advance that point there. Okay, and so now Laban becomes the recipient of deceit, and his father-in-law tricks him. And so apparently there was some sort of a custom here where typically the oldest daughter would get married before the younger daughter. And I don't know what Laban was thinking. I could kind of imagine at the beginning of the 7 years, he figured surely by the end of 7 years, Leah's going to be married, so no big deal. But when the end of the 7 years come, no one's married Leah. And so he thought this isn't a good thing. So he tricks his almost son-in-law into marrying the wrong girl. I don't know exactly how that happened. I'm kind of thinking maybe she had a full face veil on. And, of course, they didn't have electricity and stuff like we do. And maybe arranged it so it's, you know, by time the wedding ceremony's over. Or you know, I don't know if it started and then went into the evening or if it started in the evening or whatever it was. He didn't realize he was married to the wrong girl. He didn't figure it out till the next morning, probably when it got light. And all of a sudden he looks, whoops, that's the wrong person. And, of course, he was upset with that, came to his father-in-law and said, you know, what have you done? Didn't I agree to marry Rachel? You gave me the wrong daughter. And Laban tells him about the cultural problems of marrying the younger first. And so he says, I'll tell you what, give it a week of spending with just that wife. Then I'll give you the other daughter also. And so he got to marry Rachel the following week, but he had to agree to work another 7 years off for her. So I'm kind of surprised Jacob didn't negotiate, like figured if in his mind Rachel was of such higher value, he should work off less than seven for the other wife. You might say, well, that'd be kind of mean. Well, wouldn't be the first time that Leah in her marriage knew she was second place, and that's going to be one of the things that's kind of a shame about how the family dynamics turn out, is that everyone knows who Jacob's favorites are. Well, we're not going to take time to go into, you know, parenting thoughts on that or marriage thoughts on that. Well, except to say, well, that's not really God's model of having multiple wives. You know, there's a verse in the Bible that tells us this: at the times of this ignorance, God winked at, but now commands ye all men everywhere to repent. The wink there is like a blink. It's not like a wink wink, but a blink. And I've mentioned that verse before. Well, you know, this is a time period where God's a little generous in patience and allowing some things that are less than ideal. But what you see from the beginning, Genesis, the book of Genesis earlier, that it's a man and a woman. And you see this confirmed with the teachings of Christ. And so it's consistent in the scripture that God's model is one husband, one wife, not husband and in this case, it's going to eventually be four wives that he has. Well, let's look in, you know, kind of skipping ahead. We're not going to really read out of the next passages, but I'm going to go to the next slide. There's a slide here that shows a chart of Jacob and his family. And so in this this material is found in Genesis chapter 29 and also chapter 30. And I'm, for those of you online, I'm kind of turning for those in the room here and just going to use the laser pointer on it. But online, you'll have to, you know, kind of keep track of where I'm at. So you see across the top row, he married Leah first. Then the whole top area that has numbers 1 through 4, 9, 10, 7, 8, all those kids that are listed there, number 1 being his oldest son, so his firstborn son's Reuben, and all of these, in a sense, come from Leah. Okay, so you see the lines, of course, it's like a genealogy tree, the line connecting Jacob and Leah, they're married, and then the line going from Leah down. Leah gave Jacob 6 sons and a daughter, and so Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. Now, Issachar and Zebulun came later, so when she got done giving birth to Judah, it seemed at that point that maybe she wasn't going to be able to bear more children. She was thinking that. Now, at that point when Judah is born, not long after that, Rachel, who God had not allowed to have any children yet, she comes up with this idea, and so we look down where Rachel's at, and Rachel's married to Jacob, his second wife. She says, "Let me give you my handmaid, take her as a wife." Now, I have to admit, I've never really fully understand the concept of a concubine. I kind of sort of get parts of it, but concubine was a wife, but my best way of trying to think of it is almost like a second-class wife. I don't know. Anyways, he takes Bilhah as a wife, Rachel's idea, who says, "I'm going to have children through her." And so Rachel figures now when Dan and Naphtali are born that she's been able to kind of have children through her handmaid. Well, then Leah sees it and she says, "Well, it doesn't look like I'm having more children. So, hey, Jacob, you take my handmaid. And why don't you have some kids by her?" So then Gad and Asher are born. And then after that, the Lord allows Leah to have more. And we see that clearly. The Bible is showing God working behind the scenes in allowing certain things here. Issachar and Zebulun are born. But then God allows Rachel to have children, and Joseph is born, later Benjamin. Okay? And so, and then, of course, much later, after we read the events of Joseph, Joseph, down there in the bottom left, will have two children, Manasseh and Ephraim. All right. Well, I must say that I'm glad my family dynamics are not like Jacob's family dynamics. I'll leave it at that because we're trying to do an overview and keep it moving along. But I would not take Jacob as a model of how to operate in a family unless you would like a lot of conflict and hardship in that. Okay, let's see. Now, let's see. In this process of time, Jacob says to his father-in-law, I think it's time to go home. I want to go back to my home area. Laban negotiates with him to get him to stay longer. The negotiation ends up being this agreement they have that blanked out his name, Jacob. Jacob will watch his father-in-law's sheep and still continue work for him and care for his flocks. But he doesn't want Laban to pay him directly. He just says, "Let's do it this way. Any of the flock that are speckled, have spots on them." The King James uses words like ringstrake, speckled. Any of those types of animals, let me have those. And so God allows, God's blessing in this, by the way. We've seen this over and over again, God working in the lives of these people to direct things. Now, when I get ready to go to Joseph, on my own mind, quite a bit is the sovereignty of God and getting to see God's providence or his pro-videoing, that is pro, beforehand, videoing, sight. God sees beforehand what needs to take place, and he directs. And so you see a lot of God's direction in this, and I think I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that topic, except to say that it's one of the lessons we can learn from these, that God directs. And what's interesting is all the different things that God directs through. He directs through chance meetings with strangers. It happens one time with Joseph. He directs through the evil actions of people. He directs through the good actions of people. Okay, he directs through natural events, like natural disasters, so forth. Well, the point is this. God is sovereign. Whether people are doing what's right or wrong, no matter what's going on with nature, God is able to accomplish what he wants to. And so God is not the author of evil when men do evil, but God can accomplish through the events that are going on what he wants to. And that's just an interesting thought here. And God does this with Jacob. He blesses him and increases his wealth. And long story short, Jacob, every time he sees really healthy, strong animals, he puts these green, like green meaning like fresher sticks in front of them. And somehow that causes them to give birth to animals that have the speckles and spots like he would get. Now, of course, the Lord's behind this. We don't, you know, it's not witchcraft or something with a green stake and that's somehow magical hocus pocus on the animals so they give birth to a certain type. Obviously, God is just working through this, sort of like, you know, the battle later we see with Moses, where when he holds a staff in the air, Israel wins, and when he holds it down, they lose. Well, there's no magical thing about, you know, some sort of holding this up and casting a spell over the army so we win. No, this is just God directing in it. So God blesses Jacob, and Jacob's wealth is increased a lot during this time period. Of course, Laban's own sons don't like this, and they're kind of like, we, you know, get him out of here, because he's going to take all our inheritance from us. Because what he would do is when he had a weak and sickly animal, he wouldn't put those sticks in front of him. So then Laban's sons were getting all these weak, sickly animals, and Jacob was getting all the strong ones. And, you know, genetically speaking, I think whatever these spots and stuff were on the animals, I think was probably a more of a recessive trait and would not have been a majority trait in the flock. But under God's direction, he's getting the majority trait, all the strong animals going his direction. Well, anyways, he then does, at the end of this period, head back home where his father Isaac and mom Rebecca live. But remember, he's got a brother back there that wanted to kill him. So he's very nervous about this, and he's taken a whole group with him, as we saw on this chart, with all kinds of kids and wives, and now he has all kinds of flocks and possessions, and he's heading home. We're now in chapter 32, and we'll look in chapter 32, verse 22. I couldn't remember what my next slide was, so we won't go to that until we get to Joseph. Okay, so in chapter 32, verse 22, as he's traveling back home, he gets up in the middle of the night, and he takes his wives, his two wives and his two women servants, those are the concubines, and all his sons, and they pass over this creek, or maybe more properly, probably a river. And he put them on the other, or sent them over on the other side. But that then left him alone. Okay? You know, one commentator mentioned that he believes that, you know, he was staying alone. He wanted to pray. And we see that kind of event happen here, even though it doesn't say that's why he stayed on the other side alone. I think it would make sense. And so on the other side, it says in verse 24, Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. And it says, when he saw he prevailed not against him, that is, this other man did not prevail against Jacob. This other man, tells us, touched the hollow of his thigh, verse 25, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And the wrestling match continued. And in verse 26, this other man said, let me go. It's almost morning. And he said, I'm not going to do it unless you bless me. Well, I'll pause there for a moment. I think Jacob, I think it would make sense. And let me actually just read. Let's see. Make sure I have this. Let me read this one commentator's description of this. Evidently, much had to be effected in his character, drawn out in his character, before he could become one of the great spiritual forces of the world. Remember, God's transforming him. God can do that with us too. And we ought to be continually growing as Christians. Well, he says, evidently, much had to be affected or drawn out in Jacob's character before he could become one of the great spiritual forces of the world. And his supreme discipline came in that midnight wrestle. The angel who wrestled with him could have been none other than the Son of Man, who was also the angel of the covenant and the Son of God, using terms that are, you know, mentioned elsewhere. So, you know, when you come across these events, there's not always complete agreement on exactly who that was. Like, who was he wrestling with? We know who Jacob was, but what about the other guy? And I think the majority opinion amongst Bible teachers is that this was a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Sometimes it's called a Christophany. You also see in the Old Testament appearances of God, a theophany. But you also see appearances of angels. Okay? And so there's not complete agreement on this, but I think, like I said, the majority, at least that I've heard over the years, it says, it was not that Jacob wrestled with the angel, which it describes as an angel. By the way, the word angel refers to a messenger. But sometimes these appearances appear to be not just simply a messenger, but in this case, as he says, believes it's actually Jesus. Okay, and we see in one of the passages, verse 30, where after this whole event is done, Jacob says, I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. So that was how Jacob worded it in that spot. Of course, at the beginning of this, it was just described as he wrestled a man. Again, it would be like a fleshly appearance. And just like Jesus, the Son of God, the third member of the Trinity, took on a human body. Apparently that happened from time to time in the Old Testament. And so this commentator goes on to say, it was not that Jacob wrestled with the angel, but that the angel wrestled with him, as though to discover and reveal his weaknesses and to constrain him to quit reliance on his own strength. So we wouldn't, you know, we ought not to think at any point here that actually Jacob was stronger than God and God just couldn't get out of his grip. You know, those of us who have been parents, which is, is, you know, probably a majority of people listening, since this is more of an adult Sunday school. You know, sometimes you let your kids win at something. And so it's not like God couldn't defeat Jacob, but he was, in a sense, letting him win. I know my oldest son's not here to hear this. He's heard this story before, but remember I was talking about how people wrestle with pride? Well, there's no exceptions to that I've seen yet. And my oldest son is not an exception to that, so I could say this with him. I'd probably say it if he was here. When he was younger, I was letting him win at chess. When he was first beginning, I didn't want to beat him every time. I thought that might discourage him. So sometimes when I played, I let him win. I would make mistakes on purpose, and it would give him a chance to, like, take a piece. And so, but then he started getting a little cocky about it. I don't remember now what he said or did that I could tell, but he was starting to kind of think he was hot stuff at chess. And so I thought, well, that's not good. So then I changed strategy and I started smacking him down every game. And he was confused at the time because I didn't want to just come right out and say, well, I was letting you win. At the same time, I didn't want his pride to get swelled up. So I just started winning every game for a while, so he didn't win a game for quite a stretch. But later, when he was older, I told him what I had, you know, what was going on there. And he was kind of confused why all of a sudden he couldn't win games anymore. And I figured maybe it was good for his ego there a little bit, not to get too full of himself. But, you know, I kind of imagine that with the angel, kind of letting him win a little bit. That would be consistent with the fact that we know that God has all power. So it would just totally make no sense at all that Jacob could actually overpower him. But he allows this wrestling match to go on. Why? He's transforming Jacob in this. And sometimes God does that with us and brings things into our lives to transform us. Now, part of this wrestling match is that hollowing of the joint there. So now, you know, some sort of a I don't know if it's a shrinkage of a bone or what, something kind of, now it doesn't work. He's got a problem with the hip. He's going to walk the rest of his life with a limp after this. And I don't think I copied this down, but I did see one commentator mention that, you know, this would have, you know, this whole thing would have caused him really to lean on the Lord and become more dependent on him. And I think that's the kind of growth he was getting in Jacob's life, becoming more God-dependent. Now, this is a God-dependent event, because remember what's happening. He's stayed over on the other side of the brook to seek the Lord's help. And we see the desire for the Lord to bless him. But this is, bless me with Esau coming up. Also, just, you know, bless me, period, with, you know, the confirmation of this covenant that you've made with me. And so I think this is a time where Jacob is really turning to the Lord in prayer and has his own personal wrestling with the Lord in his life. I don't know if you've ever had that experience. I've had times where I wrestled with God. And God often has a way of bringing us into submission in those times so that we learn, okay, I can't, it's not in me. I can't do it myself. And so I need God. I can't do this without him. I need him. And so it's one of those moments for Jacob. In chapter 33 then, Jacob lifts up his eyes and looks. And, oh, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself there. That's not where I want to be yet. In fact, what I want to do, okay, I didn't record the particular verses here, but I would, so let me describe it. So he tells, and I could have sworn I had it in here. I wonder if I put it in the wrong spot. Anyways, that's okay, I'll go off of memory. He tells his servants that I want you to go on ahead and I've got a lot of presents for you. And let's see, actually, I think, okay, I almost thought I saw it for a moment. Give me just a second, because it would be interesting to read to you the gifts that he had, just to see the magnitude of it. But if I have to go by memory, so be it. That's really strange, because I could have sworn I put it in here. All right, well, okay, there it is. It was back further in my previous in my notes. It's mentioned before in, he wrestles with God. So backing up, prior to this, he had started to tell his servants to go on ahead, chapter 32, verse 13, and he sent a present to his brother Esau, 200 goats, 200 female goats, 20 male goats, 200 female sheep, ewes, 20 rams or male sheep, 30 camels with their colts or their young camels, 40 cows, female cows, 10 bulls, 20 donkeys, 10 young donkeys with their moms. Okay, that's a huge amount of present that he sends. And then he sends them one at a time saying this, okay, first round, round one, approach him and say, these are from your brother Jacob, and he's coming behind us. Round two, another servant, same thing. Here's presents for you, and Jacob's back behind us. He's coming. Round three, so they're trying to soften him up a little bit. Round three, these are from our brother Jacob, or your brother Jacob, and he's back behind us on his way. And then we get to chapter 33, verse 1. As Jacob's approaching, he sees Esau coming with 400 men. Yikes. A little army. he's, you know, he's scared of this. He divides his family up, spreads them out. He's hoping, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So he doesn't know what his brother Esau is going to do. He spreads out his family, his four wives, each of the wives with his own, with their own kids that they gave birth to, spread out in four different groups. And when Esau, chapter 33, verse 4, meets up with Jacob, it says he ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. So obviously, then, happy ending to it. Esau, at this point, is not going to kill his brother. He's happy to see him. And so there's been some healing in Esau's heart. We get in chapter 35 now, skipping a couple chapters ahead, we get a second confirmation of the Abrahamic covenant with him. It says, God appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Paddan Aram and blessed him and said unto him. And then it goes on to describe in the verses that follow confirmation of the Abrahamic covenant. We read at the end of chapter 35 that Isaac and Rebekah pass away. And then, just kind of looking at the time here, I think I'll go ahead and begin the next point. So we'll go into the life of Joseph here. And so now we have Jacob and all his kids living back in the promised land area, the land of Canaan that's been promised to Abraham and his descendants. And we read in chapter 37, verse 3, that Israel, now I didn't read that account there, but we read, and let's see, that's another one. I don't think I included this in my notes, but I think it's in chapter 35 also that he gave Jacob his new name. And so now anytime we see the name Israel, that's Jacob. Okay, and of course, the tribes of Israel are going to come from the names of Jacob's children, which are the children of Israel, therefore the name of the country. Okay, so now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age and he had, okay, well, it's the son of his old age, yeah, it's not just like, hey, because he was born when I was older, I like him more, but it took a long time before he finally got a son from his favorite wife, the wife that he really loved in the beginning. And so everyone knows that Joseph is the favorite. Now, he'd have been better off not parenting like this, but it was obvious. And he made him a coat of many colors, chapter 37, verse 3. It says, and when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren or his brothers, they hated him, hated Joseph, and could not speak peaceably unto them. You know, I just kind of felt sorry for the brothers. It's a shame when a parent makes their kids feel that way. But the fact is, it's what it is. The brothers direct their bad feelings about this towards the brother who's receiving the extra attention. Not that it's Joseph's fault, but still, they direct the hatred towards him nonetheless. The coat of many colors is a symbol of that. We're very used to having clothing with colors. I mean, we can get clothing of all kinds of colors. You can go into Target right now. I'm sure you can find almost any color you want in there. Well, maybe not every single nuance of shade of every color, but if you want to go in there and find something red, you can do it. Blue, purple, green, yellow, any of it. Okay. Well, back then, not so easily found. Of course, a lot of these colors come from natural dyes. And so to get a coat of many colors, that was a very expensive coat, very special. And sometimes these dyes are not easy to come by. And sometimes special dyes came from other regions, so they involved trade, which involved trade routes, which involved long distances to carry certain dyes from other regions of the world. And so this was quite a fancy, expensive gift from his dad. And the brothers are all looking around at their own jackets, and no one gets one like that, only Joseph. Okay? Well, it's those types of things that make them hate Joseph. But then we have Joseph having a dream. And he says, tells us that in verse 5. And in verse 6, he says, here I pray or ask you this dream which I've dreamed. Hey, guys, everyone, attention. Hey, I want to tell you this dream that I had. Now, I'm not sure exactly how old Joseph is at this point. Actually, for this lesson, I didn't go back and try to see if it's clear. I've always had the vision of him being probably a late teenager, maybe about 17 years old at this point. But I don't know if we got the exact time frame for his age. But anyways, he says, I want to tell you about this. And so in the dream, he says, we were binding sheaves in the field. Well, in our picture, that's where you see Joseph in the foreground laying down. And behind him on the ground, there are sheaves. They would bind up the wheat and other things, tie them up into kind of a column so that it could dry. Well, I've kind of seen that. You probably have too in our area since Hollister's known for hay production. When they cut the hay down, they don't just bale it right away. They got the machines that rake it up into a row, and they got to let it sit there for a little while because they got to let the hay dry out. Because if you bale it, all that wet hay, and you bale it and stick it all together with all that moisture inside, it's going to rot. It's going to get moldy. So they let it kind of fluff it up. Lots of air moving around. What's it doing the sheaves? Get them up and bind them together and let them dry out there. And he says, we were out there binding our sheaves together. So this was a common thing they were doing because it's agricultural society. And he said, hey, guess what happened? All your sheaves stood up and made obeisance to my sheaf. Well, no one wants to hear their kid brother that they already don't like telling them that. And it says his brother said, well, shall thou indeed reign over us? They knew what he was kind of implying in this. Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and his words. And then he dreamed another dream, and he told it to them. And so this is pictured here in the sky there. He said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more, and behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. Well, it doesn't take the rocket scientists for them to figure out that the number 11, there's 11 brothers. Even his dad, when he heard this verse 10, his dad said, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and all your brothers indeed come down, come to bow down ourselves to you? So even dad wasn't that thrilled with it. But dad didn't have the hatred reaction that the brothers had, because he loves his son. But there's maybe a mild rebuke here. Because the sun and the moon are mom and dad, and the 11 stars are all the brothers, and all of them are going to bow down to him. And again, his brothers, verse 11, envied him. It says, but his father observed the saying. So he got a little bit of a rebuke, but dad kind of was thinking about that. He's not sure what to make of that, but he's observing it or thinking about that saying. Okay, so then we come to our next slide. And because of the hatred that they have for Joseph, we're going to see some events happening. Well, in verse 13 of 37, Israel says to his son Joseph, aren't your brothers over feeding the flock in the area of Shechem? Yeah, I want you to go and send them a message. And so he was out there trying to do that. But when he got to the area of Shechem, he couldn't find them. And it says in verse 15, a certain man found him. So he bumped into a stranger. And behold, he was wandering in the field. So Joseph's out there trying to look for him, wandering around. He can't find his brothers or the flock anywhere. And the man asks him, saying, what are you looking for? And he tells him, and he says, oh, yeah, verse 17, I think I heard them talking, and they're going over towards Dothan, another town. Okay? Well, this is one of those examples, by the way, where God is directing. And so is it coincidence he ran across this guy who happened to know where his brothers are at? I mean, if he couldn't find him, he would have returned home. But God's directing because he wants things to happen to Joseph. Okay, so the brothers see him coming, verse 19, and they say, behold, this dreamer cometh. Okay, it's not complimentary. So they're not saying, oh, look at our little brother. He's such a dreamer, and he has thoughts of his future and dream. No, this is a slander. It's nasty. This is a little dreamer coming. And before he even got there, verse 20 says, they were saying to themselves, let us kill him and cast him into some pit. We'll throw him in a hole in the ground, bury him. And then we'll just tell our dad that an evil beast has killed him. And then we'll see what comes of those dreams of his. You know, little runt. All right, and then verse 21. Oldest son Reuben heard this. He wasn't up for that. Now, Reuben didn't like Joseph, but he wasn't up for murder. And so when Joseph heard it, I think I've gotten the impression here that he realizes that he can't alone really control all his brothers. Now, he's not happy with Joseph, and he doesn't like him, but again, he's not wanting to kill him. And so it says there in verse 21, that he heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands. How did he do that? Well, he talked them out of it. Okay, and he said, well, let's not kill him. Let's cast him into this pit here. But let's not kill him. And now what Reuben was thinking, he was going to try to sneak back later and free his brother and send them back home. Okay, so that's what Reuben wanted to do. Now remember, they're watching sheep and animals, and they're wandering around. Well, they're not all just sitting around the campfire. I mean, they're often off working and doing things. Okay, and so then, apparently when Reuben wasn't around, one of the brothers, Judah, in verse 26 says, well, what good's it going to do us personally if we just kill him? Why don't we sell him? Look at those, you see that band of traveling merchants over there, which were apparently offspring of Ishmael, the Ishmaelites, Midianites. Let's just sell him to them. Those guys deal in slavery and they deal in trade. They're on their way down to Egypt. Let's just sell him. Now, that would make more sense because at least, you know, not only do we get rid of Joseph, we get some money in the process. Kind of crazy. I'm thinking, like, who has the freedom just to grab someone and just turn him into a slave? But apparently in that part of the world at that time, you could do that. So they grab Joseph and they pull him up out of the pit and sell him to the Midianites. And tells us verse 29, when Reuben returned into the pit, Joseph was not there. And he tore or rent his clothes as a sign of his grief. But the deed is done. Joseph's gone. So they make up the story like they had originally thought about doing. They took Joseph's coat, which they had already stripped off of him, tore it, put blood on it, and brought it back to their father. And the father thought, okay, he's dead. Look, there's clear evidence that he's been killed. And children tried to comfort him, but he says in verse 35, Jacob or Israel would not be comforted. And he says, I will go down into the grave unto my son, mourning him. Thus his father wept. And the previous verse talks about him weeping for many days. And so this was super hard on Jacob. And then it tells us in verse 36, the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And so Joseph's going to begin his life in slavery down in Egypt. And we'll pick up at that point next week. Okay? All right. Because we're doing an overview, again, one of the points I've enjoyed the Bible study. It's chapter 5 of a book I've shared with you before, Not by Chance, Learning to Trust a Sovereign God. I've done it recently in chapel with the kids because we have kind of a sovereignty theme for this year as our school theme, spiritually speaking. And so for us, it's that same thing. We're just going to see God work. And here, through the evil actions of his brothers, God directs Joseph where he wants him to go. Through the chance encounter with a stranger in a field, God directs him where he wants to go. Through dreams, he directs in this and even predicts there what's going to eventually happen to him. We're going to see God over and over in the life of Joseph direct things in his life. And we'll see some profound conclusions that Joseph eventually comes to about all this, but we'll do that next time. All right, well, let's go ahead and stop there for today. And let's close our time in prayer.